Hi, PD Stories listeners. We just wanted to take a moment to let you all know we wish you are staying safe and healthy during this challenging time. Thank you to everyone for doing their part to stay inside for our collective well-being, and a very big thank you to all the first responders out there keeping us safe. This episode will include sensitive content. Please visit the show notes for more details and listen at your own discretion. Welcome to PD Stories. I'm your host, Tom Morris Jr., crime reporter and DC Special Police Officer. I'm excited to welcome NYPD Sergeant Ben Yao of the 5th Precinct today.
I'm running as fast as I can. I'm looking at all my Marines, and then they said, like, you know, he's shot.
Sergeant Yao has had a full career. He began with the Marines in the Middle East, then came back home to New York City's Chinatown, and now has become the Neighborhood Coordination Officer for Chinatown. For short, you'll hear us refer to it as NCO.
A lot of Chinese family, they don't reach out to the police, and they don't like to announce their business, especially with domestic side.
If you joined us last week, you remember our conversation with NYPD Chief of Patrol Rodney Harrison, who has brought this program to life. And today, we sit with someone who is on the streets, making it a reality in his local community.
I have a lady that lost hundreds and thousands of dollars.
In the blessing scam.
Yes, in the blessing scam.
Welcome, Sergeant Yao.
Well, thank you, Tom.
Now, tell us about your path through life that led you into law enforcement.
I was in the military for 5 years, a Navy corpsman. Okay, I got in the military since I was 18. So,
was that a goal you had as a kid?
No, you know, just like any teenager, you know, going through high school, didn't know what I wanted to do. So, you know, military was the best way to, you know, just help me guide myself into, you know, a better direction.
And You ended up overseas, right?
Yes.
Tell us about where you went and what you did.
Well, as a corpsman, I was assigned to a Marine division. Okay, I was attached to the 2nd Battalion, 2nd Marine Division as an infantry corpsman. So I've been to deployment with them for Macedonia, Kosovo, Bahrain, and during Operation Iraqi Freedom, and we went ashore in Iraq. Yes.
Now, you were Navy corpsman, right?
Yes.
But you were embedded with Marines.
Yes.
Which Navy and Marines are all sort of a joint service.
They don't have a medical department, so we provide them with like me as a medic to a unit. So for the Marines.
Yes. Corpsman in the Navy is a medical.
Yeah, hospital corpsman.
Hospital corpsman.
Yes.
And so, you know how to triage gunshot wounds and all that stuff.
Yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Because when you're out in the field, there's no doctors.
Did you have to deal with any injuries from IEDs, improvised explosive devices in Iraq?
No. Just I treated a gunshot wound. That was it. It was an Iraqi soldier, you know. So
where was he shot?
He was shot through the shoulder and through his kneecap, actually. And he was drugged up on heroin at that time. So I'm running as fast as I can, you know, go up there. And they were like, you know, that's the first thing I do. Like, I'm looking at all my Marines, they're good. And then they said, like, you know, he's shot. And they're pointing at an Iraqi insurgent. And he was just like a zombie, just walking around. I was like, I can't believe he was shot.
This was an Iraqi insurgent.
Yes.
Who was shot while high on heroin.
Yes, yes, yes.
And now you have to treat him.
We still give him, you know, first.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
sure, sure.
Yes.
Humanitarian thing to do.
Yes, mm-hmm. You know, we find him he had a bullet wound clean through his kneecap. You know, he was still dragging around. So this is like, I was very, you know, I guess the drugs was kicked in, and I gave him treatment and sent him back to the base.
How did they know he was high on heroin?
He have needles with him, and he have a track mark all over his arm. Hmm. So, yes.
That's a good story. Now, you come back to the States, and you get out of the Navy, and you take stock of your life and say, what am I going to do now? And you decide you want to become an NYPD officer?
Yes, because, you know, I hear people like, you know, it was a very stable job at the time. It was, you know, it was a paramilitary.
And you were the first person in your family to go into law enforcement?
Yes. But, you know, it was like coming from a Chinese family, you know, Chinese doesn't believe in, like, you know, they always want their kids to be a doctor, a lawyer, you know. So I mean, it was my mom was, you know, like kind of like, you know, holding back. Mm. But, you know, as she seen me in my career going on, mm-hmm. you know, she get proud. Like, you know, she started getting proud, you know. So. Mm-hmm.
Do you remember your first day as a rookie?
Yes, I remember. Actually, the first day I walked in the precinct, I got assigned to the 73 precinct. That was my first command.
In Brooklyn?
Yes, 73, East New York. So the first day I went to my command, I was walking with my gear, and it was the change of tours. I have officer coming out, and they were actually, they were going home. They were supposed to be going home to their car, and they start coming back and putting on bulletproof vests. I was like, wow. This is the place I'm getting assigned to, you know, because there was early in the day, it was a arrest that made the community angry, and they were kind of protesting in front of the precinct at that time, and the precinct is pretty much surrounded by housing, so there have been rounds ran off before.
So your first day on the job, there's sort of a mini protests, riots starting to unfold outside the precinct?
Yes, right in front of the precinct, yes.
Now, as your career started to move on through the rookie year, what was the most eye-opening thing that said to me, oh my God, I really am a police officer in New York City and this just happened and I was in the mix?
The last steam explosion around, I believe, Grand Central Station, we were actually just on scene, patrolling around the area. When I was assigned a task force, we do a mobile response within the city. And at that time, we just happened to be almost the first person on scene. It's just having the chaos, seeing people just running away from, like, the opposite direction.
What happened?
We saw that, and then we went toward that direction.
So there was an explosion.
A steam pipe explosion
in Grand Central Station.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And then people are just running and panicked everywhere.
Yes, yes.
And so what did you and the other officers do?
Oh, we're trying to provide aid. You know, we head toward that direction and see what's going on. You know, whoever in needs. We actually saw an injured person, you know, got a third degree burn on their body. And, you know, we're trying to provide aid and trying to help people direct to the, you know, safe direction. So, yeah, that was you know, it was kind of intense at the moment because nobody knows what's going on. Nobody knew it was a steam pipe explosion. So, you know, at that time, it was a lot of chaos. So.
Now, I'm very familiar with East New York, Brooklyn. I did some homicide cases there during my America's Most Wanted days. And I remember in the 90s, it was incredibly violent, like 700 shootings a year in 5 square miles. East New York is only 5 square miles in Brooklyn.
Yes.
When you got out there and started working the streets in East New York, you ran into some tough people, some tough dudes, right?
Yes, yes.
Tell me about how you had to learn how to deal and communicate with the types of people you had to deal with. I'm talking about the street boys, the corner boys,
mm-hmm.
you know.
It's just the same way, you know, you show them, you talk to every human being like they're human. It was like the first summons I wrote was actually I stopped, I was on the foot post, you know, I was...
Foot patrol.
Mm-hmm. And then I saw, at that time we were issuing bicycle on the sidewalk summons, right? This big guy, he came out, this guy was about...
So you couldn't ride a bicycle on the sidewalk?
No.
And you'd get a ticket?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And he probably like a 6'7", 300 pounds. You know, I'm a small guy. Mm-hmm. So, but, you know, he's like, I stopped him by myself. He came out of the project. He came towards me. I was like, okay, you know, stop, sir. You know, just to let you know, it's a violation. You know, just I'll ask for ID. You know, he was pretty upset. You know, he was pretty upset because the first thing he told me was like, I just got out of jail yesterday. Mm-hmm. You know, so... And you know, and I talked to him, I explained it to him, this law, and, you know, I just want to see some ID, you know. I talked to him like a person, mm-hmm. you know, instead, and he cooperated,
And did you give him a ticket?
Yes, I did.
The man just got out of jail the day before. You gave him a ticket for riding a bicycle on the sidewalk?
I was a rookie, and, that's like the first summons,
What was your first arrest?
Was a person smoking marijuana. Yes.
Imagine that.
Yes.
In New York City.
In New York City, yes.
They do that here.
Yes. More?
Yeah.
Yes. But... Same thing. He was a gentleman, I explained the process to him. I talked to him, and I contacted his wife, and I gave him the phone call. And, afterward, we actually, his wife, called me, thank you, for being a gentleman to my husband.
Do you remember the first time you responded to a shots fired call?
Yes, yes.
What happened?
Well, it was... There's a lot of shot fire call, but confirm or not, at that time it was, you hear shots fire, you go over to the scene, you make, you conduct an initial investigation, trying to find out where it come from, and pretty much you got your adrenaline going, mm-hmm. you feel like, you're going there, mm-hmm. you're gonna see somebody shooting, or you're gonna find a victim, but most of the time, shot fire going off and nobody's on scene. And the neighborhood would be like, I didn't see anything. I didn't hear anything.
Do you remember the first time you responded to an actual shooting victim that was actually on the scene, shot?
Yes. Actually, I went to a scene. It was a person reported that he was shot probably a couple blocks before. And he was sitting inside a floor of a housing apartment. And we came on the scene, and he said he was shot. We kind of didn't believe it because he got shot by the .22 on his forehead. So it was a .22. I guess the guy was shot him from a little more distant because it really just showed a glaze, and we were shocked that he got shot. So
because the .22 bullet is, for people that don't know, a .22 bullet is pretty much the smallest bullet there is. Yes. Although the .22 has killed more people than any other caliber of bullet in the United States.
Yes,
because the bullets tend to go into a body and move around and do damage to different organs. But this guy got shot between the eyes,
right on his forehead, right on his temple. But he was very lucky. It almost looked like a little, minor bruise, a little bleeding, but he didn't have any major injuries. So he was very lucky.
And to put that in perspective,
yes.
Robert F. Kennedy was killed by a .22 caliber bullet to the head.
Yes.
So that's a very lucky guy.
Yes.
Now, tell me about moving into the 5th Precinct in Chinatown, what that was like initially for you, especially being Chinese American. Yes. That had to have been pretty special, right?
It was actually a good experience because, you respond to a job
mm-hmm.
and seeing the Chinese person faces, when they call 911, especially 911 is like an emergency, the first thing they saw, is somebody that they could connect to. They see your face. They said, you speak Chinese? That's the first thing they ask you.
And you do?
Yes, mm-hmm. I do. I speak Mandarin and Cantonese.
Mm.
So it helped a lot, that way they actually talk to you, explain everything to you. And it's a connection for them. It's kind of rewarding that you could help, somebody in your community, especially in a way that, if an other officer who's non-speaking Chinese, they come on the scene, sometimes they don't understand the situation, the background, the whole story, it helped. And they feel they feel a connection with the police department when as somebody able to speak their language on scene.
And in Chinatown, you have a very unique part of the city.
Yes.
It's a huge, huge population down there.
Definitely, it's like a melting pot of the city. We got a little part of it, a little Italy, Soho, the Chinese community. And we even have a part of City Hall.
Were you familiar with it before you got assigned to the 5th Precinct?
Well, being a Chinese immigrant to the country, of course, you have to know the Chinatown. That's where we used to come when I was a little kid. That's when my mom come over and get the Chinese food and grocery shopping. And, that's like a little part of home that you could go to.
Give me an example of a problem that someone had
in your precinct that was kind of complex and kind of difficult, and you were the right person to actually deal with that person's problem and help get a resolution.
When Tom is just an old person, you know, a Chinese person, a Chinese-speaking person who doesn't speak English at all, he was probably 100 years old. You know, he was lost. He was lost in one of the bus stations. He was trying to find his way home. And actually, an American person came up to us. He was like, I think this person is lost. You know, we have no idea.
He's 100 years old.
100 years old, yes. He was 100 years old, you know. And we being come on the scene and able to speak the same language and finding out where he's coming from, and we were able to bring him home. I was able to talk to him and find out where he but I mean, it took a little while because, you know, he have a Alzheimer's and he's having problems remembering where he's coming from. But just keep talking to him, able to make that connection. And he'll give us some hint of where he live. And it was very rewarding that, you know, and he probably, like, when I see him on the street, he still remember, like, hey, you know, he might not remember how he get home, but he remember, like, you know, the officer that came and interact with him and able to brought him home that day. Mm-hmm. You know, that was rewarding, yes.
Give our audience an overview of the geography of Chinatown in New York City, where it is on the island of Manhattan, and what sections make up Chinatown.
Okay, Chinatown is, the fifth precinct is the Lower East Side, okay, from East Houston to South Street, okay, from the water to Broadway, all right? That's the South Street to Broadway, okay? It's a very small precinct, but you have the major corridor, Canal Street, you know, going through from the Manhattan Bridge all the way down to the Holland Tunnel. So it's a busy, most of the Chinese population is lower part, okay? With Canal Street, you find all the Chinese store, all the jewelry store, and the Bowery, lower part of the Bowery, you find all the restaurant, the Chinese restaurant. So
I've been down there on Saturday afternoon sometimes, and it's just so vibrant. There's so much going on.
Yes.
And it's just, it's very, very cool place. What are some of the problems that the merchants down there have to deal with? I've heard, you know, the stories of Chinese gangs preying on Chinese merchants, shaking them down, same way MS-13 shakes down the pupusa ladies and the small, you know, vendors that are trying to make a living. Every ethnic group has typically, you know, another
type of crime
yes. They're being preyed on by their own. What's the situation in Chinatown that you've seen?
Well, I've seen, like, the crime that prey on Chinese people, mostly the elderly, because there's a lot of native Chinese elderly that came here a generation ago, like, you know, then they just stay in Chinatown. And we encounter a couple of scams just preying on Chinese people. There's one that's called the Blessing Scam.
What's that?
Okay. So these group, basically, they most of them is from China, okay.
The people that have come directly over from China.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And they would come and they prey on the elderly, okay, seeing them, like, bringing their grandkids to go to school and walking by Chinatown, and they watch them. They watch them. They see, you know, they see what kind of family they have, okay, and they approach them. They approach them, hey, you have a grandson, you know, how is his health? Is he sick? Does he get sick a lot? You know, they prey on it. And then they'd be like, okay, if your kid's, like, sick a lot, maybe I know Chinese people, some of them is very superstition, okay? Mm-hmm. They feel like, you know, okay, I could have somebody pray for you, a monk, a Chinese monk that could help your child get better, better health for your family, okay? Mm-hmm. Come, let's go see this monk. Mm-hmm. Okay, and they bring them to, like, you know, they meet in a public street, you know, not a private location, and they ask, and the monk would say, okay, this is what you're gonna do, all right? In order for me to, you know, bless your family, I need you to put all your fortune, or jewelry, cash, whatever, in a bag, okay? put it in the bag. As the more, the merrier. The more is more fortune I could bless your family.
So okay. Put all the valuables you have in
your
bag.
Your life saving,
and
everything.
Give it to the monk.
Well, give it to him on the spot. Okay.
In a public place.
In the public
place.
So
she feels
safe. Like, you know, this guy is not, and he doesn't know what is in there. So he'll pray on the spot. He'll pray toward the bag, and he'll tell the lady, okay, after I pray, just open the bag, possibly 7 days from now, and open it, and your family would be blessed with health. Okay. So when they take that bag, you know, they're working in teams. So they have another bag that's really available with maybe newspaper in there, bricks, just to feel, make it feel a little heavy. They put it in the bag, you know, like a regular plastic bag or paper bag, and then they just switch it, you know, right? And they wouldn't know, and they don't know it until 7 days later.
Oh, my God.
And their fortune, I have ladies that lost hundreds and thousands of dollars. Yes.
In the blessing scam.
Yes, in the blessing scam.
Yes. That's terrible.
Yes.
Is it a real monk or a fake monk?
It's not a real monk. It's not a real monk. It's just part of the scam. It's a group, you know, somebody posts as a monk. You know. They're very organized.
And after they've been ripped off, they come and tell you and go to the police. And
yes.
Have you ever been able to bust somebody that's actually running this scam? Mm-hmm.
Yes. It's a long investigation. They were able to make some arrests, but it's still a big group out there that they would, you know, prey on these people. They got the money, they go back to China and left the country. And so it's we're trying to, at this point, we're trying to, like, educate the elder. You know, there's no such thing. You know, like, you know, don't fall for the scam. You know, we go to various senior center. The community meeting, and let the community know there's such scam out there, and just trying not to just to prevent it. You know, we're trying to do it as a crime prevention point of view, and just avoid, you know, having people be a victim.
Yeah, it's terrible. I have a neighbor. Well, he was my neighbor, and he retired from, you know, Metro after 30 years, and he didn't have any hobbies, so he got a computer and the internet, and next thing you know, somebody contacted him, and he came to me and said, what do you think of this? I said, do not talk to those people on the internet anymore. Yeah. It's a scam. Do not. Yeah. A year went by. One day, I see a for sale sign in front of his house. Yeah. I'm like, what's up? Why are you selling your house? He didn't want to tell me.
Wow.
His grandson told me. Well, his grandson told my son what happened. He got ripped off his entire life savings, $300,000,
wow,
by Nigerian internet scammers. Now he and his wife live in an apartment in San Antonio.
It's happened so much. It's also there's another, like, you know, the robocall is pretty much the same as the internet.
Robocalls?
Robocalls, you know, they targeted the Chinese community also. You know, they call in Chinese, they're claiming to be a Chinese consulate or the Chinese government. Your family in China is being investigated, and we need you to pay the bill or whatever investigation cost, you know, to try to eliminate this case. You know, so they get worried. You know, if you're calling somebody that just came over here, they have family in China, and they got worried, and they would go out and try to you know, ask, even borrow money from people, you know, just to pay it off. And then once they wire that money, it's gone. You know, I personally, my friend's mom was scammed out of $80,000.
Your friend's mom?
Yes. And she's educated.
Mm-hmm.
And, but, you know,
how'd they get her?
Same thing. It was a scam phone call. They call her. They said, your relative in China is being investigated. Please send, you know, $80,000. And she fell for it. She fell for it.
So when elderly Chinese people get the phone call, this is the IRS. If you don't give us $5,000 by tomorrow, federal marshals are coming to your house to arrest you. And a lot of them believe it, right?
Yes. They're very nervous with the authority. You know, even my mom would call me once in a while. Hey, I'm getting this phone call from Con Ed or this gas company. They're gonna shut me down. You know, should I pay? I was like, no, mom, hang up the phone. You know, so, you know, it's a scam. Pick them up. You know, don't ever pick up the phone that you don't know. So
I get at least 3 or 4 robocalls a day on my cell phone.
Yes,
every single day, yeah. And I block them, and they come right back.
Yep. As long as there's victim out there, they're gonna keep doing it. That's why we gotta prevent people from falling into these traps, and that way maybe they'll die down.
From the network that brought you the Cold Case Files podcast comes I Survived, the classic stories you know, with new interviews, updating each woman's story with everything that happens after survival.
I survived because I convinced him that I was a person.
I survived because I was a smarter person than my assailant.
I survived because I believe God saved me.
Surviving is just the beginning of their story. Subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
It's pretty common that criminals like to prey on their own ethnic groups a lot of times with scams. In this case, robocalls that are in Chinese, in Mandarin, in Cantonese, robocalls to people randomly, and they pick up the phone, someone speaking to them in Chinese. And so right away, that breaks down the first barrier of defense, doesn't it?
Yes. Because they get the mentality of the Chinese family. They're very concerned. They are very afraid of the authority. You know, the moment you say, like, you know, your official, you know, the Chinese consulate or
the government.
The government agency, they get scared. You know, they get scared, they worry, and they knowing them, like a lot of Chinese family, like we touched on that before, that they hold a lot of cash in hand, and it's just make them a more vulnerable, you know, to be a victim of these call. Because they a lot of time, you know, knowing a lot of stories, they do pay and they do fall for it. So which is why they targeted this group, like, you know, the elderly, the Asian. You know.
Do you try to encourage people not to have all of their life savings and money hidden in their house? Because I've worked on cases where Vietnamese people own a jewelry store.
Yes.
People know they own the jewelry store. They also know they must have a safe in their house.
Yes.
And have money and jewelry there. And so a bunch of guys with masks bust up in there one day and rob them and maybe even kill somebody. Do you talk to these merchants and these people about how not to become victims, that maybe you should put your money in the bank and,
yes,
you know what I mean, as opposed,
yes,
to keeping it in your house?
Oh, we're still trying to talk to them, yes. But they still, you know, we still see that. We see that in Chinatown also a lot of the times, especially with the elderlies. They don't believe in bank. They still believe in putting money in the pillow, in a can, like old can or a used can. It's just, you know, we're trying to make them understand, you know. Even with the restaurant owner, we have a case with the burglary. The restaurant owner, they've been living there for over 30 years, have a money box, same thing, like, I forgot how much was it. It was like $30,000 or $300,000. I forgot the amount. But yes.
But they had it all there.
They had it all there. You know, somebody must have, you know, followed them, knowing that they being a restaurant owner, followed them, found out that where they live, and broke into the apartment. So, you know, with that, we do try to talk to all the businesses and let them know this is going on. You know, avoid, you know, be mindful of your surrounding. Like, you're going home, you could be you know, being followed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so
what's the most serious call you've had to respond to in Chinatown?
Was just last week ago. We did have a homicide, four homicide in the Chinatown of a homeless person. It was it's still going on.
That just happened.
Yeah, that just
the
happened.
One just happened.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, it was a homeless man. He was just targeting a homeless person that was sleeping in Chinatown. And he just randomly, you know, he had a metal bar. And just the homeless person was killed by smashing the head. Yes. That really, like, you know, surprised the Chinese community and, you know, with the area. Chinatown relatively is a very safe, you know, it's a safe neighborhood. We don't have a lot of major crime. It's just this.
This was a random.
This was a random.
Have you worked any domestic violence cases in the 5th Precinct?
Yes, I was aspired to become the NCO sergeant. I was the domestic violence sergeant also, and the traffic sergeant.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
What were some of the cases you recall working on?
Oh, well, it's in Chinatown. It's just. a lot of Chinese family, they don't reach out to the police, and they don't like to announce their, you know, their business, you know, especially with domestic side. So a lot of time, I went to a case. There was a lady. She was an alcoholic. Okay, she have a long history of abuse and with the husband. Okay,
him abusing her.
Him abusing her. Mm-hmm. Yes, and it was back and forth, and she didn't want to report it a lot of time. And I try to do a lot of visit, you know, get connected, trying to find out what's going on, and she just. It's just rough because, like, you know, coming from a different country, you know, being in a new country and having a person finding a husband supporting her. So they feel empowered by, mm-hmm. by the husband, you know. So they don't want to leave that situation, you know.
The security.
Yes. Uh-huh. And being her, like, she having a language barrier. So she wasn't getting help, you know. She didn't speak English, mm-hmm. you know. So we try to get her help, you know, connect her with different agency, talk to her. But unfortunately, she passed on from a health problem from being an alcoholic. Mm-hmm. So that was tragic. Yeah.
Now, your mother was a victim of a crime, I understand, and yes. didn't report it.
No. Because when I was a little kid, you know, my mom... As most of a lot of immigrant, Chinese immigrant from the country, my mom was worked as a factory worker, as a seamstress. Mm-hmm. Okay, she traveled back and forth and stuff. And it was just one night, you know, she was just got off the train, she's just walking home, probably about 10 blocks away from the house, and she was somebody snatched her purse, you know. So, and you know, at that time I was probably like 13 years old. You know, I ran back over there and trying to find the people. Uh-huh.
she didn't
want to report it. No. At that time, we didn't have much encounter with the police. You know, at that time, it doesn't even cross the mind with a Chinese family that, you know, you take it as a loss and you don't report it. So now, with that experience, I'm trying to promote people. If you don't report it, we don't know about it. Yeah, so we want to know what's going on in the community, mm-hmm. so that way, if a lot of crime or a snatching or grand larceny is at that location, so you reporting, we know that this is going on and we could help you, you know, come to that location. We'll pay a little more attention, and it, you know, that way we have less victim, like, you know, of crime.
Now, what does NCO stand for?
Neighborhood Coordination Officer.
And what's the origin of the program in that position?
Well, the NYPD started this philosophy of neighborhood policing about 4 years ago. And it started with a pilot program. The main idea of the neighborhood policing is being more connected with the community. Well, we have three goals toward the philosophy. The first goal is always fight crime, you know, reduce mm-hmm. crime. And second is promote respect and trust from the community. Mm-hmm. And the third, of course, is collaborate with the community to reduce crime. Yes.
And when you first went into the program, did it take some getting used to as opposed to the police work you'd been doing before?
It's definitely a change because instead of going out, like, let's say we're just going to go out, I was in the condition team before. And we would just go out trying to fight crime, find any violation, misdemeanor, any felony we could observe. Mm-hmm. And now it changed from just going out there and looking for crimes. Now you're doing a little part of everything. Crime prevention, community affair. You're going out and talking to people, learning about the community. And that way, the community could actually help us fight crimes.
Once you hit the streets, what was the first memorable incident you had as a neighborhood coordination officer?
Well, it's very different. It's like you start going out and actually talking to people, you know, visiting various business owner, the community center. You start speaking out to everybody and they start learning you And they you actually feel a little connection to the community. Like this feel like home. Like, you know, this is my community also.
And there's something called Build the Block. That initiative entails what?
Build the Block is every sector, my neighborhood coordination officer, the NCO, they would have a meeting with the community that they worked in. So basically, you're having the Build a Block is having your community come to this meeting, the meeting, having a very intimate conversation with the officer, telling them what's going on in the community, what kind of problem that we could address, and anything else just going on.
Have you had to go to a community meeting that was contentious, where the citizens were pissed off and they were mad at you, the NYPD, or why can't you fix this? Or, you know, have you been to a meeting where things were, you know, community meetings can be somewhat contentious?
I've been part of that. You know, I've been in that situation before. You know, it's just let them go through what they, you know, what they want to speak. And then you're trying to connect them, or, hey, you know, you want to, could we speak, you know, on, you know, after the meeting, and trying to get connected. What's your real problem? Like, you know, what make you the way you are, like, you know, acting toward the police? Is you know,
in front of all these people.
Yes. You know, is there something we could help? You know, so we'll try to, you know, divert and help the person out, you know, if he really does help.
It can be a little uncomfortable though, huh?
It is. It's a stressful situation, you know, especially with the officer, you know. It is, you know.
Look, I serve on my police chief's advisory board. And trust me, I've seen some things.
Yes.
We're like, okay, can we like ratchet this down a notch or two?
Is it
really got to be all that?
Yes.
But yeah, people have points they want to make.
Yes. And some people just like to speak in one of those meetings. So.
True. Yeah. Some more than others.
Yes.
Are more people willing to come to the police now as a result of what you're doing with the neighborhood, you know, policing?
Yes, I definitely see a change because people are happier. Like with the NCO, you have the neighborhood that they work for, they have a direct connect with the officer. You know, they could send email, they could have you know, even with every officer in the police department have a department cell phone now. So they have a direct connection with a cell phone number, a email that, let's say, like, you know, they have a problem today and tonight on their, and the homeless person laying in front of the footstep, and they could email or just shoot the officer a text or call. And even if they're not working, they're able to connect with the patrol officer. Hey, could you swing by that location? We have a problem. And the community see a response, you know, like a direct response. And with that, they feel more safe, and then they feel, you know, more encouraged to get connected with the officer in the neighborhood. You know, that built a lot of trust with the community.
You know, in live PD, some of the most bizarre and unresolvable situations we see are when neighbors are battling, or a tenant and the landlord,
yes,
and the police come and they have to try to sort this out, but they can't really sort it out because it's a civil matter. Have you had to deal with that? And what's the silliest dispute you've had to try to resolve?
Well,
people just being totally unreasonable and they want you to fix it.
That being said, it was just about 2 weeks ago. We have a neighbor tenant dispute. It was the same thing. Well, the landlord is actually just renting that location, apartment in Chinatown, and they subleased it.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like a 2x4 room, you know. And,
2x4?
Yeah, it's enough for a space of like a little small bed. And, you know, mm-hmm, they subleased to this lady, and she don't want to pay rent. You know,
on a 2x4 room.
Yes.
Yes. What was the rent? Do you know?
I have no idea, but you know, we come on the scene, and they just, like, you know, they started. I explained the process of landlord tenant court.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they started the process, and actually, the tenant was, I guess she'd done it in the past, not paying rent. She started the process herself, you know, like...
The tenant did?
The tenant did, about the landlord illegally evicting her, changing the lock, and you know, it's still a law that you can't just change the lock on the tenants. You know, she have the right to be there, and it was a back and forth situation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're trying to say, no, please don't change the lock. You know, you can't change the lock, but you can't. They have a shared common area, you know, which is a very small apartment already.
And sounds like it.
Yes. Being in with a common area, you know, you're always gonna run into each other, and they call like constantly, becoming like the moment the other person come in face to face with each other,
they run into each other in the kitchen.
Yes,
is on.
Yes, so it was a tough situation that it's hard to resolve. You know, so
it's still unresolved.
It's gotten better. You know, yes, but
Sergeant, what was the hardest case, most difficult case you've had to investigate?
I wouldn't say investigate. I came to a translating job, a special victim call for a translator, and I have to respond to a hospital. It was it's a 1 year old child, maybe less, 6 months to 1 year. He was at home with the mom. And he was placed in the bed while the mom was tending to cooking or whatnot. And he fell off the bed and hit his head. So, you know, being such a small young age, the child, you know, they have to do their thorough investigation, make sure there's no child abuse. You know, having that translating and ask all the question with the mom and seeing, it's almost like, and seeing the father holding that child, you know, that's rough. You know? So, you know, I have a daughter myself, so, you know, seeing a young dead body and, you know, being in that situation, I can't imagine what the family going through. But also, you know, being the NYPD side, we still have to investigate, rule out all the suspicions, you know.
So the infant died.
The infant died, yes.
And then you had to interview the mother.
The mother, yes.
In Chinese.
Yes.
Sergeant Yao, after a particularly stressful call for service or a stressful day, how do you take care of yourself and keep your mental health in perspective and keep everything, you know, in a good place for you?
It's always good to talk about it. You know, it's always nice to have. It doesn't even have to be a conversation. It's just letting somebody know what you're going through.
Another officer or family member?
Officer or family member. Somebody you could use talk to, and it helped. You know, like coping with someone. Because when I was in Iraq, I was almost in charge of the mental health of the Marines. You know, it's a stressful situation. We have Marines on the line. They going day by day and don't know what's going to happen. You know, it's stress, and they're leaving home. They're getting extended. You know, I have to go through each Marine and make sure their mental health state is okay. You know, by that, I just go around and talking to them, like, you know, how you doing? You know, it's because it's always help. You know, same as for the department, it's always help out there. You know, somebody you need to talk to, anybody, and it's just talking it out is to able to get that release off your mind, you know, that stress, you know, having somebody that understand, you know, like you said, talking to another officer, it helped that mental state to, you know, bring you back to the level.
Yes. It feels sort of like an epidemic in a way. We just had an officer committed suicide in Montgomery County, Maryland, where I live. It was called in as a disturbance of suspicious people. Mm-hmm. And when officers got to the scene, they found the officer dead on the scene, and they didn't realize at first that it was a suicide. There was a whole manhunt, and helicopters were up looking for suspects.
Yeah. It's a scary thought. One of the officers that recently committed suicide, I do know him personally. You know, I worked with him in the past. It's just sad that, you know, maybe if he reached out, you know, earlier, or somebody reached out, that way you're able to connect or prevent some, you know, it's a hard situation for somebody, you know, especially you know that person, You know, everybody know, you know, some way or another, like, you know, everybody deal with stress differently. You know, somebody, you could just go work it out, you know, or just go to the gym and you know, or have a nice meal and, you know, talk about it, or whichever way. But, you know, I just feel like, you know, in a way, you gotta make sure yourself is okay before you help others. You know?
Well, it always seems that people say, I had no idea he or she was at that point. I knew this person, but I've known someone who committed suicide. I've known about 3 people that have committed suicide, and they weren't police officers, but we didn't see it coming.
Yes.
They seemed outwardly normal. This person, this officer you're talking about, could you ever imagine that he would commit suicide?
No. He was very... Like, you know, he was a happy person at work. You know, he was joking. He was always joking around. It's just, I could never saw that coming. So it was very shocking at that time. Yes.
How would you characterize your career as a police officer? If you had to explain to somebody in a couple of sentences what it means to you to be an NYPD police officer and what this career and the badge means to you, how would you explain it?
Well, being police officer, you're always gonna be a crime fighter. You know, you wear the uniform. You're not just representing yourself. You became a larger family. You know, the NYPD, the Blue family, and everything you do, everything you say, everything you it affects other person, and also it's a lot of burden on you. You're out there responding to a call of emergency, because that's when somebody's in need, and you are that saver, like, you know, coming on scene, like, you know, a lot of times, you know, if a person really need help, you're that person, you know, the knight in shining armor that show up. So, you know, you gotta earn it. You know, it's just you think about it, it's like, you know, you gotta love the job. You know, you gotta willing to help people. You're here to wear that uniform to help somebody, you know. So it's a very rewarding job. It could be stressful at times, you know, but you should always remember that at the end of the day, you know, you're helping people out there.
All right. Well, it's been a pleasure having you on the show.
Right.
Sergeant Ben Yao, 5th Precinct, NYPD. Keep up the great neighborhood community work out there and stay safe.
Okay. Thank you, Tom.
Thank you for joining us today on PD Stories. If you enjoyed today's show, please subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts so you never miss an episode. And like us on Facebook.com/PD Stories for more information. You can also catch me on A&E's Live PD every Friday and Saturday night at 9 p.m. Eastern. PD Stories was created and executive produced by Sue Funk, with producer Julie Magruder. Our editor is Steve Delamater. Special thanks to McKamey Lynn, Tisa Cassidy, Alicia Acuff, and the teams at A&E Networks and Podcast One for making this show possible. Until next time, I'm Tom Morris Jr.